Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another Tech Doctor podcast. This is Robert the Tech Doctor. Along with me is Allison Hartley. And Allison, how's it going way down there in Florida?
It's going well. We're getting into week 3 of guide dog school already. I can hardly believe it, but it's going real well.
Well, you're soon going to be a graduate.
Yeah.
That's exciting. You can take that
I'm
new
so
dog.
So excited.
Take that new dog home and let the fun begin.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's just excellent. That's an exciting time. Having been through it several times myself, I can really be excited for you. So that's very cool. Well, today on the podcast, we're going to speak with a woman that I actually heard about several years ago because she's had such an interesting career, and it sounds like it's getting ready to make it even more interesting with graduate school. Her name is Jean Parker, and she is here because she is an audio journalist. She has been a broadcaster and has lived in India for many years, but is currently in the U.S. as a graduate student. So, Jean, welcome to the podcast, and please take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us a bit about who you are.
Thank you, Robert and Allison. It's good to be here. Well, that's a kind of an open-ended question, isn't it?
A little broad, huh?
A little broad, yeah. I am at present primarily a graduate student in a doctoral program, and I think we'll get to that a little later. I worked in India for 10 years as a radio journalist, largely for European and North American networks, including NPR, a little bit for BBC and CBC, and also some other networks. And I also taught. I taught on the university level radio journalism at several universities in India, several programs and institutes in India. You were asking about background, and I often say that all of this started when I was very young. I grew up in the U.S. and I lived in the U.S. Through early adulthood. Then I worked in Costa Rica. I've also lived for a short time in Cambodia. But as a young child, when it was time for me to go to school, there really weren't any options for my education except for a residential school. And as it turned out, in the place where I was living, the Perkins School for the Blind was the obvious choice. I was there for 5 years before transferring to a local public school. So when I was a student there, I went to school with and had colleagues and teachers and other faculty and staff from all over the world. And so the people that I had regular contact with were from China, from Japan, from Botswana, from South Africa, from various parts of Europe and Latin America and all the rest. And for some reason, I was never satisfied to simply hear about those places. I wanted to go to those places and visit them. And so that has been a lifelong pursuit of mine. It was to travel and to visit places. And in fact, I can safely say that I have visited or lived in many of the places where people that I met at Perkins and in other places came from. I think that was also boosted by the Talking Book program here in the United States, where I was always interested in books about other places or that took place in other locations than the ones that I knew.
You've always had an interest, it sounds like, in the idea of experiencing other places and exploring other places.
Yes, yes, very much so. And that continues today.
Were any of those people that you met at Perkins, were they like mentors for you, or were they people that you really connected with somehow from the different cultures?
I would say a fair number of them were. They were from anywhere that you can imagine, and they were in the U.S. to either as students at Perkins or to be trained to teach blind people. So the blindness part of it wasn't really of interest to me, but the fact that they came from such diverse locations and were traveling to this country to further their education was of interest to me.
And I did not realize that Perkins School had such a diverse group of students and faculty from all over the world like that.
That's neither did I.
They did, and they still do. They have a very large international program. and one of their focus areas is international education, and they work in several dozen countries.
You were very young at that time, I assume, but so this has been really a lifelong passion or interest for you that sounds like happened really early.
Yes, it started very early.
Were there other influences from family or other places at that time that supported this idea that a young girl would want to, you know, travel throughout the world the way that you've done?
Well, I was never really told that I couldn't do something on the basis of blindness. And so there was support in that regard to pursue this kind of activity, I guess. I became very interested in political issues in Central America, and that was probably the first time that I really started to explore places and ideas that were not on the tourist agenda. And I've never been a tourist in the traditional sense. I find it very unusual for me to actually go on holiday or to go on vacation to become a tourist. One of the interesting things that I experience from time to time is that having lived in India for so long, someone will come to visit and they'll say, well, where do you think I should visit? Well, I have no idea. You know, I have very seldom been a tourist in that country or in any country, really. I've always gone for some other reason.
So you really travel somewhere with a purpose in mind, it sounds like, or with a reason to accomplish something, or is that kind of the idea?
Yes. Yeah. And then if I visit something on the side or have some extra time or something, all well and good, but I have never viewed tourist destinations, museums and amusement parks or things like that, as anything I was interested in. Now, having said that, there have been times when I have visited countries for this or that reason, and I've chosen to go to perhaps the National Museum or to visit some other place where visitors go. But my strong preference is to associate and to stay with local people. I do stay in hotels, but my preference is to not stay in hotels, but to stay in people's houses or a small guest house or something that benefits the payment that I'm making benefits someone in the local economy instead of a hotel chain or something. Now, obviously, sometimes you can't avoid that kind of thing, but it isn't my preference, really.
It sounds like it also gives you a way to sort of get some grassroots experience of what it's like to live and work and be in that particular country.
Exactly. And so I think it's been a huge advantage to have had the opportunity to do that.
Did you do traveling as a child, or has this all been done since you grew up?
We traveled as a family in the summer, and we traveled within the U.S. and also Canada. We did not at that time go outside of the U.S. for a number of reasons.
You at least became comfortable with the routines of traveling and being in different places and things like
yes.
that.
Yes, and we traveled except for one occasion when we did take a bus tour as a family to Yellowstone because it seemed to be the most expedient way to do it. We traveled on our own. We went somewhere, rented a car, took a train, and we would put together these excursions on our own. And so I saw my father doing it. My father was the main instigator in all this. And so he did it. And so I kind of grew up observing that and knowing how to do it.
Sounds like he passed it on to his daughter, huh?
Apparently, yeah, I guess so. My paternal grandfather was also a traveler in the early part of the 20th century. He was an engineer on a yacht, on a sailing vessel. And they went around the world three times at a time when people didn't travel that much to Asia and North Africa and so forth. And so I grew up hearing the stories about those trips of his, and he brought back a lot of artifacts, which I still have, from those places where people didn't really go unless they were diplomats or missionaries or something else, or they had a lot of money. And so those stories were very much in my family's narrative.
Yes, and I don't doubt that that's important in the way that this has unfolded for you. So apparently you left Perkins after a few years, went to public school, and then what kind of education did you pursue beyond high school?
Well, I had a probably pretty typical high school education. I did participate in acting school, in drama and so forth, and so through that became very comfortable speaking in public and using my voice, and had a little bit of experience with radio early on in college, in university. My experience with radio came much later as a profession. I've had several careers, and sometimes I combine them together and sometimes I don't. I was trained in human services, which I had absolutely no aptitude for at that time, and in those days, that was the thing that people did. And I soon got out of that and began working as an activist. I was involved in many different kinds of movements, as you would say, I suppose, social movements and this and that. Made my living doing that. And eventually I got involved in Radio for Peace International, and that was a shortwave radio station in Costa Rica that operated in from about 1987 until we were put off the air at gunpoint in 2003. It operated from a coffee plantation in Costa Rica. And so I began as a producer, a content producer, radio producer. I did produce a disability program. I also produced a lot of other, should I say, left-leaning content for the radio station. And then I eventually was on the management team, did fundraising, and I did staff supervision. I taught there also in the institute that we had. I was very much involved in the station for about 10 years, I guess.
Sounds like a great training ground for some of the things that you've done after that.
It was. It was. I really learned and understood then how to handle audio equipment, how to do interviews. It was a very good training for what I eventually went on to do. And that was to be a radio journalist. When I arrived in India, it was right around the winter between 2001 and 2002. I started to realize that there was an awful lot going on, and India was just then beginning to become, I think, on the radar screen of a lot of people in the West. The economy had transformed over the past 10 years or so, and so it was now beginning to gain a lot of attention as a player, mostly in the corporate sector. Software development, call centers were just starting, all of these things that Westerners were getting services from or somehow involved in. And so I came into network journalism at a time when people were becoming very interested in India. And so the stories that I covered, some were about India's economic rise, and I say that in quotes because also has been in many ways a very destructive process within the country. I also did stories most significantly in my view on human rights and social development. So I was doing stories on land use, more precisely land misappropriation, land grabs, and the kind of disenfranchisement of poor people that was and is going on, that was not apparent in what they called at that time the India shining mantra. So that's what I began to do.
How did you go about getting a job in India? Sounds like that would maybe not be such an easy thing to do, especially with all these things just beginning to develop and evolve and all that.
Well, when I went to India, I had a set of skills that was in demand. I had community radio experience, and I had an amateur radio license. And the combination of those two things gave me an advantage that at that time was something that I could really exploit to get work. And so that, of course, has now changed. There's a great deal of involvement now with community radio, although that has all of its own issues going on with it. I got a lot of teaching work for quite a few years. And this was also a time when radio in India was opening up. Prior to early 2002, all of the radio in India was monopolized by the government All India Radio. So since 1927 until 2002, the only radio that you got on the local channels in India was All India Radio. If you wanted to listen to anything else, you had to have a shortwave radio. In fact, we listened to Sri Lanka radio a lot to listen to Motown, to be precise. And so that was a sort of tradition that we had before the radio channels began. Now, when radio was privatized in India, it was privatized to the commercial corporate sector. It was not privatized at first to community radio. And at that time, it looked like they might open up to do things like documentary producing and public affairs and talk shows and call-in shows. And what happened is that the government said very quickly, no, 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 we're not going to allow you to do public affairs and news on these FM channels, these private radio channels. And so that really put a damper on radio's ability to do anything except for play Bollywood music, movie, and dance, cinema and dance tunes that were, and to do celebrity profiles that made them money. So it really became a money-making operation.
Is that the reason they didn't want the documentaries and so forth?
No. The reasons that they gave and still give, now this is according to the government, India is a place with a lot of security issues, insurgencies and so forth, and they don't trust the radio stations to provide news content to the general public. Now, the inconsistency with this is that India also has, it's either 800 or 1200, I don't know, cable television channels, which are totally unmonitored and left to do whatever they want to in terms of news and live coverage. And they have been responsible for many problems when they're doing live coverage of an attack of some kind. And I'm speaking specifically of the 2008 attacks on Mumbai, where they were really instrumental in giving information to the instigators of this attack that they then used to perpetuate it for several days. And so the inconsistency between radio and cable television is there. For some reason, they feel like they want to have more control over radio. Now, the community radio policy came in two waves. It came in campus radio in about 2002, where universities could have stations, and then the actual community radio stations in 2006. The policy of the government on the community radio stations is very limited. And so as a result, as we'll get into, I think, probably later, there's been a lot of development of some very interesting mobile phone platforms for content sharing, audio content sharing, which is part of what I'm using in my research currently, that have developed to get around this licensing government ultra control of the sector. The other piece of that particular time period, though, is that I taught in university, and I originally went to the Symbiosis Institute to see about entering a doctoral program at that time. And they said, well, you can go ahead and make application and all, but in the meantime, would you like to teach for us? And I said, sure, why not? And so I taught for them for 5 years. I taught for at least three other institutes as well. By then, we were looking at people who wanted to be trained in working with community radio. And so I taught for several institutes and entities that were working on community radio.
Just to make sure that I'm understanding, is community radio a relaxation of sorts of government policy, or it sounds like perhaps it's a way to get around some of the government restrictions. Am I getting that right?
In the United States, community radio stations would be like the smaller NPR affiliates.
Right.
A lot of them are run by campuses, college campuses, but not all.
Right.
I suppose the Pacifica stations might be a parallel universe to community radio station, but they are stations that are run by a community, by the people in that community to produce coverage and content on the issues that are important to them.
So they're run by the people, not by the government.
Correct. It's people's radio. Now, the government in several instances has tried to take over some of these frequencies by saying that they were going to start what they call community radio stations. But the philosophical, the ones that are purely community radio stations are run by communities. They're financed locally or by UNESCO or something. And they are run as NGOs. They're nonprofit entities.
And the government obviously tolerates that.
They tolerate it. They go back and forth on the news and public affairs policy. Sometimes they say they're going to relax that policy, and then some other ministry comes back and says, oh, no, we can't do that. That's too risky. The stations have to get around it by calling things educational programs and that kind of thing. The final thing I want to say about that is that the country of Nepal, which has significant security issues, a civil war that is at times ongoing and at times is a little less of a conflict, but it's been a major armed conflict for many, many years. They have a vibrant community radio sector. The Indian government just has no reason to put forth these reasons for this control over the sector and dragging their feet to issue licenses and taking several years to issue licenses and putting bureaucratic hurdles in the way. And I mean, there was a time when I think you had to apply to 21 or 29 ministries in order to get permission to set up a community radio station. Now that has been reduced significantly, but it's not an easy process to get through the bureaucracy to do it. After I finished working for Radio for Peace, I did not work for a network as an employee. At that point, I had been out of the traditional employment routine enough that I had no interest in pursuing work as an employee in the traditional sense. Moving on to what has motivated the work I'm doing today is that one of the stories I was asked to cover by a program in the United States was the 2004 South Asia tsunami. I was sent there, and I arrived about a week and a half after the event occurred. And it was one of many disasters I covered, but it was by far the most impactful in terms of what I came away from the experience with. And what I noticed the most, I did my stories, my human interest stories, and I broke a story that had to do with low caste people not getting their compensation payments and being kicked out of the shelters that had been built by these aid agencies that would come in and not have a clear understanding about how to distribute aid in a country that has a caste system and religious divides. And that's a very complicated social landscape. I talked with people who had been denied water in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami. So they lost their livelihood. They lost their meager houses. They were denied entrance into the shelters in the camps that had been set up. And they were also denied access to water. Several of the women I spoke with had been sexually assaulted after the tsunami. So they had been through a lot, and their lives are very difficult to begin with. The aid agencies came in with tarpaulins and tents and food and water, but they did not come in with the simple item of sanitary pads. Now, of course, you have to interview women separately to find out about this, and in that part of the world, you usually do interviews along gender lines. They were using materials that were off the side of the road, and so they had been exposed to diesel fumes and the dirt and the filth. Of course, the place was full then of trucks, relief trucks, and all coming in and carrying off debris and the rest. And so they were beginning to experience a lot of medical complications because of this. And that simple item that these aid agencies couldn't even figure out that was needed, people had lost everything. They were sitting in the mud. And I know they were sitting in the mud because I went and I sat in the mud with them. By far, the most difficult aspect of this particular event was communications and the ability of people in local communities to know what was available and where to find it and how to get there and to be able to communicate with each other. There were about 10,000 people who died in South India in the tsunami. Altogether, it was somewhere between 220 and 250,000 people who died. Now, when the event happened, a lot of family members were at sea because these were fishing communities. And so the first trip I made, I spoke with a lot of people who had no idea where their family members were, whether they were still alive or not. I went a total of 3 times, and it just kept bothering me that why is it that community radio can't be used in a situation like this to do 2 things: assist people to prepare for and mitigate emergencies, and then to be the center of communications for reconstruction and recovery and all of the different aspects of reconstruction and recovery that are best carried out with a community that's empowered rather than one that's a, quote, victim of a disaster. The equation of rescuer and victim, which we see so much of the time in the world, where an aid agency or a government is rescuing people from a disaster and that they're victims and they're called victims, I prefer to look at it in an empowerment sense of facilitators and survivors. And so I really had a strong opinion about this based on what I had witnessed both in covering that event and then also other events. And I began to put the pieces together of what has now become my doctoral research.
So tell us a little bit about that. You had these ideas, you saw these horrible things that happened, and from that you begin to realize maybe community radio could be of great assistance here. And I get that there are some ideas you had about how that might happen, but what's happened from there? What have you done with it?
Well, I was very fortunate to have been accepted into the PhD program of the Da Vinci Institute in South Africa. There's a requirement in that program that the colleagues have to do something that's transformative. So you can't just write a thesis about something and have it stay in the library and just circulate among academics. You have to do something that's actually transformative to the society. And so some of the colleagues, for example, are working on sustainable agriculture, or they're working on economic development, micro-lending, or there's even one of the colleagues in Germany who's working on spirituality in the workplace. I really wanted to look at what's called participatory communications and disaster management and education. And this has evolved over the past several years to go beyond community radio, because in India, community radio is very limited. I really wanted to combine this with the kind of mobile phone platforms that are very popular in South Asia to promote community resilience and self-sufficiency.
How would you combine mobile phone and radio in that sense?
Well, what we're doing is that we're looking at this in a very broad sense at the moment. the radio stations that I've chosen to work with, there are five, and they're in the North Indian state of Uttarakhand, which is by Tibet. And so this is a very mountainous region. And in June of 2013, there was a massive flood and landslide that killed about 6,000 people, many of whom were never found. And so this galvanized the population into mobilizing around emergency management in all of its phases. And so the community radio stations then became very interested in doing content development for their communities on disaster preparedness. Now, for them, a lot of this has to do with misuse of the environment and illegal dam construction and really some scientifically unsound things that are going on with diversion of rivers and illegal building construction and unconstrained economic development, illegal mining that was going on. And so, of course, in order to not get lost in these root causes, and they do look at the root causes of things, we then bring those issues down to a point where, okay, how do you then transform that into an education program that is relevant to the local community and contains action items for them to do, whether it's community mapping or resilience strategies, evacuation strategies? How do you tell if a building that you're in is one that you should stay in case of an earthquake or some other event, or one that you should leave? Because, of course, in mud construction, if you're on the first floor of a mud-constructed building, you have to get out. But if you're in a concrete building, the universal wisdom is that you stay in and get under something, you know? But this doesn't always hold true. And so the question then becomes, how do you assess your own environment to make those decisions? And how do you integrate those processes into everyday life so that they're not separated from the normal course of going about your everyday business? The existence of illiteracy doesn't mean that people are stupid. And so people are perfectly able to take information that they get from the Red Cross or some other source and customize it to their particular needs. And so the second part of the project, the research project, is to then take that content and put it onto a mobile network where people call in to leave messages, and then those messages are consolidated, edited, and sent back out on the network, and people listen to those messages by mobile phone. These networks reach hundreds of thousands of people. In fact, they could reach a global audience because they are run through the internet. So the hub of the operation is somewhere in Bangalore or somewhere that runs through the internet, and then it's sent back out onto the mobile platform in local languages. And that is a whole other issue of these participatory communication devices, is that if a local community is to be reached and to include those who are on the margins, it has to be in whatever the language is that is spoken in that region. And that may or may not be one of the official languages of India. And in the case of Uttarakhand, it is not. They're using several languages, none of which are a part of the official language matrix of the country.
So you're trying to reach people in the margins, as you're saying, at least part of is what you're trying to accomplish. Do these people have mobile phones? Do they have this technology available to them?
A lot of them do, and there are parts of India that are not covered by mobile phones, but there are more people who have access to mobile phones than have access to community radio and can both leave messages and be the recipient of messages and content over the mobile phone network. And this is one of the ways that media people, community media people, have used to get around these restrictive policies of the Indian government. We find that people listen often in groups or as families, and sometimes, especially in the rural areas, a mobile phone is shared by many people.
They call in somewhere and listen to information, and they can also, it sounds like, share information on that same network, but they have to know to do that, right? They have to know how to go about that.
Right. So they have community organizers who go around and teach people how to do that. They have outreach people who do that. Now, they can call in, but they can also leave a missed call, and their call will be returned so that they don't pay for that call, because most of these people are very poor. And so if they want to hear a message or respond to something, they can receive a return call for them to be able to do that. Now, these networks are able to facilitate discussions. They would be what radio people would call a tape delay, I suppose. They are able to run surveys and campaigns on things like maternal health, and they're trying to put an end to early marriage, childhood marriage, in these rural areas. And so the one that we are working with is very interested in taking this radio content and repurposing some of it for use on the mobile networks, and then facilitating these exchanges between people.
That's a fascinating use of mobile technology that has never even occurred to me before now.
Right. It doesn't work in the event that in a catastrophe the mobile networks go down, as they did in Uttarakhand. Mm-hmm. And so that's the whole reason for the self-sufficiency strategy, is that you can't count on communications being available.
In the U.S., we do a lot of that kind of, if mobile phones go down, emergency communication with amateur radio, which I'm part of, and I know you're a part of, but you were telling me the other day that actually in India, amateur radio doesn't play a very strong role in that kind of disaster communication. So it looks like there would be a real deficit there if the mobile phone system was not working.
Yeah, it can, and it certainly has the potential to, but the disaster management in India is still very underdeveloped and disorganized for many, many reasons that, again, are beyond the scope of this discussion. It doesn't often reach communities, which is the reason for all of this. There's a lot of corruption, a lot of misappropriation of funds, a lot of donated money goes missing. That's why the self-sufficiency strategy, if the government or an aid agency comes along with something, all well and good. If they don't, the ideal situation is to be prepared to do without it, particularly in the first stages of recovery. And so then if they do come along, a community is organized and empowered enough to tell them what they need and where to put it. And this came from the kind of things that people were given after disasters in India and South Asia that were just inappropriate.
I think it's really fascinating that you saw the big picture on that and have begun really working and studying in this area to try to make some significant improvements here. That's pretty exciting, actually.
Well, one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that so many times people view disaster management as things, and often they're technological things. And after this first happened, and in subsequent earthquakes and cyclones and so forth, it's always about early warning devices, and those are important. But to me, the real meat of this is processes and people and relationships. And it's also about unification. In order to have a really comprehensive disaster management plan, it has to include everybody. Nobody is there yet. Not even the most developed disaster management communities are inclusive of everybody, but they're working on it and they try. In and of itself, it can also unify communities if they really take it seriously and look at it as a necessary community-wide inclusive process. Now, this is a very, very long, arduous process in a country like India that has so many divisions and so much animosity often between various communities.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Just hearing you talk about it, I realize, at least even scratching the surface, it's very complex and very long range.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Well, one thing I want to be clear about is that my role is as a catalyst in this. I am a foreigner in India. I am not Indian by birth, even though I live and have lived and still live for extended periods of time for a very long time in India, in the last 14, 15 years. I did not grow up there. India is very sensitive about foreigners. And so there's only so far that I, as a foreigner, can go in making this happen. And so my role is to network with NGOs, nonprofit organizations, or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who are interested in this, and to do research on the findings and then to disseminate those findings between both Indian and global interested parties, who can then take that information and do something constructive with them, something transformative. My role there is to facilitate an empowerment process that really they're doing the primary research. They're doing a lot of the primary research that needs to be done. And so I did a lot of shuttle diplomacy for about a year, going to New Delhi and talking to this one and that one and the other one, and finding out what would be a good fit for organizations that could work together and that were interested in doing a collaborative project. NGOs in India are very territorial, and they unfortunately oftentimes do not work in collaboration with each other. So this was not an easy process to develop a collaboration like this. I had to exploit my relationships over the last 10 or 15 years to make it happen. And I did do that. But
I'm sure you did. Would you please tell us a little bit about what it's like for you when you are living in India? What is life like there for you? And I'm interested in what it's like for you there as a person, but also whatever you'll tell us about how you think blindness affects or doesn't affect what your life is like there in India.
Well, that's a bit of a complicated question. There are, of course, logistical issues that come up because of blindness and disability that do not come up in the United States. It's a bit difficult to explain in a concise way. The physical environment is much different than it is in the United States. There's no architectural standards. In the place where I have lived, there isn't a traffic signal for probably 5 miles. And these are very, very heavily traveled trafficked roads. There's very few compliance with any traffic regulations that might exist. And so it's not uncommon for someone to be traveling on the correct side of the road and they decide they want to go in the other direction and they just simply turn around and go in the other direction. That's very common.
So how do you keep from getting run over?
Well, I think that blind people have to ask for assistance more in those environments than they do in a place like the United States or in Western Europe. What I have heard from blind people is they say that blind people in developing countries such as India rely on human assistance more often, and that blind people in North America and Europe rely on technology more often. Technology is usually not available to blind people in places like India. Having said that, you have to have very good mobility skills in a place like India to survive. And people who are poor, blind people who can't afford to have drivers and assistants and servants tripping over each other and all the rest, they have to have very good mobility skills and be very confident in their travel ability. And many of them have never had a day of rehabilitation or orientation and mobility training in their lives. They just simply don't have access to it. And so you find a lot of ingenuity, a lot of inventiveness among blind people, a lot of resourcefulness about how to get from one place to another, because, of course, they have to support their families. I was telling you the other day that one of the role models for me as a blind person is a fellow called Mogre, who is a poor person. He was a laborer, day laborer in construction. That was what he did to make a living. He had an accident. I think he fell off a roof or something, and he became blind. But he had a family to support. And so he got a job as, of all things, a courier with an NGO. And so his job is now to carry papers, documents, often large sums of money from one office to another. And he goes everywhere on his own, and he's never had a day of rehabilitation in his life. He uses a stick, and it is a stick. It's not a cane as you would have in the United States. It's a stick he found somewhere. And he probably does not use it in the correct way that some mobility instructor would prefer that somebody use it. But he gets from point A to point B, and he's still alive. So,
wow.
But as far as my experiences, what I find is that, of course, it's very difficult to walk on the roadside in India. There are lots of obstacles. You're walking in traffic, usually. There are produce sellers, people selling things, people sleeping sometimes, people sitting on the roadside. There are ditches. Sometimes there are open sewers occasionally, you know. And you're walking in traffic with trucks, motorcycles, buses, rickshaws, dogs, people, sometimes buffaloes, cows, etc. So it's a bit of a chaotic environment to navigate in. But what I enjoy about here is that I can go from place to place on my own at a good pace, and that actually going someplace for a walk has some physical fitness results. You know, it's not such a tedious business as having to literally be mindful about each step and where I put my feet. Now, having said that, my cultural transition coming to the U.S. from India is much more difficult than it is going from the U.S. to India, because I go often. And so when I come back here, I'm uncomfortable with the amount of space that's around me and the amount of aloneness, physical aloneness that I have. You know, in India, it's a very large population. It's a very crowded place. I find it difficult sometimes, after I get used to the fact that the traffic is on the opposite side of the road, becoming accustomed to the amount of space in the street and that things are so big, things are so open. Is disorienting sometimes. The fact that things are done by machine. I had a very difficult time learning again how to use laundry machines, because we do our laundry by hand. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I remember using a coin-operated laundry for the first time in many years after having had domestic help and having my laundry done by hand, which I still prefer, by the way. And just standing there and not knowing what to do. I had no idea what to do.
You mentioned having had domestic help. So I'm assuming that in India, you're in a position where you're able to have an assistant, have a driver, things like that.
That is actually a common aspect of middle class life. And so if you're at all in a professional class, such as myself, it's expected that you would have domestic help and drivers and an assistant and so forth. That has nothing to do with blindness, but it lends itself, that cultural aspect lends itself to a blind person having a functioning ability, which is, at least in this aspect, equivalent to a sighted person. Now, having said that, blind people, including myself, experience a great deal of social exclusion in a place like India. There's a lot of sometimes very ingenious notions, that inventive notions that go on about blind and disabled people that are reflective of a society that exists on categorization of people into particular groups and communities. It's a complicated business, but I will say that my blindness, it does have, of course, its technical challenges and logistical challenges, I think the logistics, the actual moving around, is easier to accomplish in India than it is in the United States, simply because it's expected that I would have a driver. And I did radio work in India and South Asia that I could never do in the U.S. because of transport limitations. I think that in this work I'm doing now, it gives me a perspective that I would not otherwise have, because I'm never really far from my own experience of exclusion. I don't think it's helpful to compare oppressions or to compare people's experiences with social and economic exclusion in the way that so often takes place. Mine is worse than yours. And so I'm not going to do that. But what I will do is to say that being a part of a group that experiences social exclusion on a regular basis throughout the world and navigating life as a part of that group gives me a perspective on the kind of marginalization that takes place and ways that we need to really work to lessen that marginalization and to promote inclusion and bring people together into a unified human race. That's kind of a lofty statement, but it's my experiences of mistreatment and social exclusion are never far away because they happen on a regular basis.
If I'm hearing it, you've turned it into, in some ways, empathy for what others go through. And there's that's a powerful statement there.
Yes,
I think so. If I hear a statement like, well, we can't translate something into a local language, it's just too much. We can't do it. It's too expensive. It's too much work. It's too much whatever. I say to myself, now, wait a minute. How many times and how often do I have to fight for a document or a piece of information that has not been accessible to me for some reason? Because it's too much work or too expensive or whatever. And so I think in a position to apply that experience to this question of, well, if this is a document that is relevant, or even if it isn't relevant, we still have to make it relevant. We have to translate it into whatever their language is. And India has language problems. It always does. Everyone has language problems in India. There's always an issue with having things available to people in local languages.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of use you make of accessible technology in your life here and in your life in India.
Almost all of the technology that I use now is such that I have to be able to put it in a backpack. I have to be able to carry everything on my back. I opted to go with an 11-inch MacBook Air, which is very lightweight. That's my only and primary computer. I don't need anything else. I have a very small note taker called the Sika Mini, which also acts as a braille display. So again, very small, very lightweight. And I carry two mobile phones. The reason, because I was very fortunate to have been able to acquire an iPhone also about a year ago. But sometimes in some parts of the world, it's not easy or convenient or cheap to acquire the kind of SIM card that's necessary to use in the iPhone. So I do carry also a Nokia phone, which uses a regular size SIM card. The other reason for that is the Nokia can be fixed on any street corner. You know, the iPhone is still the Apple environment, the Apple platform. And so you have a bit of a disadvantage, actually, in some places where repairs are not easily accomplished. You know, you have AppleCare and all of that, but then you have to manage it within that environment. I've been in some places in northern Laos, for example, where you know there's no Apple repair service center for hundreds and hundreds of miles and maybe thousands of miles in any direction. I do use two BookPort pluses, and the reason I use two is because I sometimes have the need to record both a primary research source and a translation of that source, or a translation/description of that source, as I prefer to call it. And so I run two parallel lines. If it's on the computer, I would run a line from my computer through a book port and then onto a headset in one ear. And then I would run a line from my iPhone through the other book port into my other ear so that I have the primary source coming from one side, the translation coming from the other side. If I have two book port pluses, I don't have to be bothered with doing the recording settings and things on two different machines. It's just all duplicate. I can hit record at the same time and the same thing happens. And then I take those two files and put them into an audio editor, balance the volumes properly, mix them together, and I have a more or less real-time translation of something. So these are protocols that I've been able to develop as a result of working in radio with technology. Ham radio has played a big part in being able to figure out how to solve a particular problem. The other piece of that is that, of course, the translator could be anywhere in the world if it's done by computer. Obviously, if it's a live in-person exchange, the translator slash describer would be in the same room, but they would be translating on a separate recording, which can then be mixed together. So it's these kinds of problems that have to be solved, that must be managed, you know. And I would say that ham radio has played a big part in my ability to do that. And I don't really use any other technology.
But the technology that you do use, you have to win the award for creativity and
yes,
adaptability.
Yes, you're great facts.
Are there any other people who are doing the kind of work that you do who are also blind or have significant disabilities?
Well, I don't know. I have never heard from any, and if there are any who listen to this podcast, I would certainly be interested in hearing from you. One thing that I really have learned in India is that so much of the time, the solutions to things can involve technology, but not necessarily. They don't have to involve technology.
Yeah,
sometimes
exactly.
There's a very low-tech solution to something that can take place. Now, in America, of course, the landscape is different. It's a different social context. And so sometimes technology is the correct answer. But I think it's always helpful to look at a problem from lots of different angles and to say, is this something that can be solved by a $5,000 piece of equipment, or is it something that has another answer or a combination of other answers? Sometimes the $5,000 piece of equipment is necessary. Sometimes it isn't.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Gene. You've been very gracious to spend this time with us here. And I think that in a number of ways, we've really touched on some issues that probably a lot of people, including myself, have not given that much thought to. And that's one of the things I love about doing this podcast is it stretches me to think of different things in different ways. And I very much appreciate your willingness to come and talk with us a bit. Thank you for being here.
Yes, well, you're welcome. And thank you very much for doing the podcast and giving us an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, it's really been delightful. And Allison, we've had a bit of trouble with your signal here, but I think you're back strong now. Anything you'd like to add to all this?
Well, I just want to second that we always gain such a fresh perspective and new knowledge of people on such a global level from doing this podcast, and you've certainly added to that today. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. It's been a really, really enlightening conversation.
Well, you're very welcome. I know how much time it takes to do a regular production like this, so I think we all appreciate your time and attention to it.
One of the things that I'm really left with today, and I was left with this impression when we talked briefly the other day, Gene, is that you're one of the people who acknowledges your blindness, but you are a person who has passions and interests and who acts on those passions and interests and does traveling and does your work. And yes, blindness is part of that, but it's just a characteristic. It's just one of the things that's part of you, and it's not the thing that you mostly highlight. And I really love that so much, and I think it's important for Tech Doctor listeners to kind of open themselves up to that, or to be aware of that in some sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do think that, and try not to let it become an over-identifying aspect. Obviously, there are times and places and environments where it does come to the forefront. It comes and goes as to its level of importance in a particular task or at a particular time when I'm interested in doing something. And yes, I have always enjoyed traveling and going to places. I don't enjoy the experience of actually getting there anymore, mostly due to you know, airline policies and things that are not good for the public. I've been to some pretty strange places. I worked in Libya, for example. I have worked in South Africa, and I've worked in Southeast Asia and Latin America in some pretty, I would say, if not hostile environments, certainly environments that one should think about.
Absolutely. And because you've been so many places and done so much, maybe next time you're in the U.S. or next time we can work it out, we may have to have you back and talk about some more of those places, because we just scratched the surface here.
Well, I would be happy to do that.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. And thank you, Allison, as well, for trying to hang in there with a bad Skype connection.
A really quite faulty Skype connection. I apologize for that.
Perhaps a bit of a sick MacBook. Hope you get all that straightened out.
I sure hope I do too.
Oh, that's not good. I'm so sorry to hear that.
A recent listener asked me if I would start including more contact information on the podcast. So as a reminder, you can email us with your comments and questions and thoughts at techdoctor@drcarter.com. That's techdoctor@dr-carter.com.
Please send us emails, guys. Please. We want to hear from you.
Yes, we do. We do have some email that we will follow up on the next podcast. So for now, this is Robert the Tech Doctor saying so long from me.
And this is Allison Hartley and her gimpy Mac saying bye, everyone.